Thank you. So can you hear me? Is this working? Yeah, this is working fine. Is it too loud, actually? Yeah, okay. It's perfect. Good. So the truth is that for the last 8 years or so, cosmologists have been coasting, telling themselves what a wonderful time it is to be thinking about cosmology, because 8 years ago, in 1998, we figured out what the universe was made of. The 1990s will go down in human history as the decade in which we figured out what the universe is made of. This only happens once in the history of the world, and it was 8 years ago. So that's good. So we have an inventory, we have a story that we can tell about the universe that sort of snapped into place in 1998, one in which only 5% of the universe is ordinary matter, particles that we have detected in the laboratory. Another 25% is dark matter, some completely new particle but is still made of particles. And 70% is this dark energy stuff that, as I will tell you, is making the universe accelerate right now. So that's an inventory of the universe, and in 1998 it was given the award by Science Magazine as breakthrough of the year when they discovered that, which is important. In 2003, the WMAP satellite basically confirmed that we hadn't made a mistake, and that was again voted the breakthrough of the year because the previous breakthrough was so implausible that just not getting it wrong was worth another breakthrough of the year. Again, a couple weeks ago, WMAP confirmed that it's still right. Probably we will not win the breakthrough of the year this time. But it's a reminder that even though we actually claim to now understand what the universe is made of, the problem is that this universe makes no sense to us. We do not understand why it is like that. And so at some point, we need to stop congratulating ourselves for having discovered these things and start making progress in understanding why it is like that. It is now time to get serious. So I will give you no answers to the difficult questions of why the universe is like that, because I am too old to be creative enough to come up with such answers. My job is now to give talks where there are young people in the audience who will be inspired to think about these deep questions, answer them, and in their Nobel Prize acceptance speeches will recall the day that they heard that talk that made them think about these issues. So I'm happy to play that role. To remind you about cosmology, I like to say that cosmology is the perfect field for people to go into if they have a short attention span, because the universe, on very, very large scales, is an incredibly simple place. The universe is a much simpler system to study than a high-temperature superconductor or James Joyce's Ulysses or the European Constitution or other things that you might study as the object of some academic discipline, because the universe looks the same everywhere on very, very large scales. You can look at galaxies and so forth. We live here. There are other galaxies around us. But if you average over very large portions of the universe, the number of galaxies and their distribution is the same everywhere. There's nothing really to say about it. Fortunately, it is changing as a function of time. The universe is expanding. The distance in between different galaxies is growing as a function of time. That's what we mean when we say the universe is expanding. The amount of space in between the galaxies is getting bigger. So bound systems in this ensemble do not expand along with the universe. The galaxies themselves are not getting bigger. Atoms in the galaxies are not getting bigger. You are not getting bigger. Or if you are, it is not because of the expansion of the universe. That's a local effect. And we don't know how big the universe is. It might not even make sense to talk about the size of the universe. It could be infinitely big. But we know the relative size. We can say it takes so and so many years for the universe to double in size. So we invent a number, the scale factor, which tells us the relative size of the universe. We plot it as a function of time, and Edwin Hubble years ago found that it's getting bigger. So A is a function of time is going up. We can also trace it back about 14 billion years ago to the time when everything was basically on top of everything else, and everything was very, very hot and dense, and we call that the Big Bang. So one of the things the cosmologists would like to do is to understand exactly what this curve is. A is a function of time from the Big Bang to here and into the future. To do that, we need to both understand what's in the universe and the laws that it obeys. So the law that it obeys is given to us purportedly by Einstein's general theory of relativity. And again, it's a simple universe, so it's just a differential equation in one variable, which is the time. So this is the Friedman equation. It relates the expansion rate of the universe, h. H is the Hubble constant. H is a dot over a, where a is the scale factor. And it's related to rho, the energy density of the universe, which is the same at every point in space, in this approximation where everything is perfectly smooth. And kappa, the spatial curvature. So space-time has curvature because of two things. Because it's expanding, space is expanding, and also because space itself at any fixed moment of time could itself be curved. So the curvature of space could be zero, and it could be like Euclid said. It could be a positive number, as if we were on the surface of a three-dimensional sphere, and if we made a very big triangle and added up the angles inside, they would be greater than 180 degrees. Or it could be less, like we were living on a big saddle, and then some of the angles would be less than 180 degrees. So kappa is a constant. Rho is a function of the scale factor. It changes as the universe expands. So if you know what rho is, and you know how it changes as a function of A, you could solve this equation. So it's a first-order differential equation, and you could get that function, A as a function of T, telling you how the universe has expanded since the Big Bang. So we want to sort of know what is kappa, what is rho, and what does rho do as a function of A. So you might ask yourself, what might rho possibly be? What is the energy density of the universe consisting of? And cosmologists, again, basically have two favorite things that you could put in the universe, which they call matter and radiation. So to a cosmologist, matter is any set of particles that are slowly moving compared to the speed of light. The reason the speed is important is because for particles that are slowly moving compared to the speed of light, their energy comes from E equals mc squared. And m and c and squared are all constants. So the energy per particle remains the same, but as the universe expands and gets bigger, the number density of particles goes down. So the energy density in what cosmologists refer to as matter just goes down because the volume is going up, whereas the number is remaining constant, and you get rho matter is proportional to a to the minus 3, 1 over the volume of some fiducial area of space. In contrast, for radiation, which to cosmologists is any set of particles which are moving at or close to the speed of light, E does not equal mc squared. E equals h nu, where nu is the frequency. And a photon is not a bound system. It loses energy as the universe expands because its wavelength gets stretched. So the wavelength of a photon goes as the scale factor. So it gets redshifted from blue to red as the universe gets bigger. Each photon loses energy like 1 over A. So the number density of photons goes as 1 over A to the minus 1 over A cubed. The energy per photon goes as 1 over A. So in radiation, you would get rho going as A to the minus 4. And these are the two main things that you might expect to make up the universe. In fact, the amount of radiation in the current universe is much less than the amount of matter, and that's no surprise. If you started out with some comparable number, the radiation would go away much more quickly, and therefore matter would be winning. There is a surprise when you ask, what is the matter that we see? So here is, not quite a photograph, but a reconstruction using data of where the matter is in a cluster of galaxies. So here's a cluster of galaxies. All these little orange galaxies are orbiting each other under their mutual gravitational field. And you look at galaxies in the background of this cluster. And you ask, the background galaxies have images that have been distorted because they've passed through the gravitational field of the cluster. There's a gravitational lensing effect due to the amount of mass and energy in the cluster of galaxies. The good thing about gravitational lensing or other gravitational effects is that they don't care about how bright something is. They only care about how much stuff there is. So you can weigh the cluster of galaxies to exquisite precision, knowing that you haven't missed anything using gravitational lensing. And this blue is the computer reconstruction of where the mass is in that cluster of galaxies. So in addition to the galaxies you see, even in addition to the X-ray gas that is in between the galaxies, you need a lot of matter in that cluster of galaxies to explain the gravitational lensing results. So we say that there is matter there, and we call it dark matter. This is not quantitatively the most convincing evidence for the existence of dark matter, but it's the prettiest picture. And there's many, many different ways to measure the amount of dark matter, and they all give the same result. The result that they give is that you need about 5 times as much dark matter in the universe as there is ordinary matter. When I say ordinary matter, I mean every particle that has ever been discovered in any experiment ever done, ever, anywhere here on Earth. The entire standard model of particle physics consists of only 5% of the universe, and 5 times as much of that is this dark matter that we have not yet discovered. So we're trying to discover this both in particle physics experiments and in direct detection experiments. 10 years ago, I would have given a fascinating colloquium just about this, but now this is prosaic, everyday stuff. Let's make a prediction based on the idea that the universe is made of matter and radiation. Here is the Friedman equation that I showed you before. H squared is A dot over A squared. All I've done is I've plugged in for the energy density rho, rho matter plus rho radiation. So rho matter is a constant over A cubed, rho radiation is a constant over A to the fourth. If we multiply both sides by A squared, through the miracle of math, we find that A dot squared goes to the constant over A plus a constant over A squared plus a constant. What you see is that every term on the right-hand side either remains constant or goes down as the universe expands. So as the universe expands, there's a prediction that this number goes down, therefore that number goes down, therefore A dot should be decreasing as a function of time. That's why conventionally we'd be plotting A as a function of t as this curve with a diminishing slope. We make a prediction that if the universe is full of matter and radiation, it should be decelerating. A double dot should be a negative number. We occasionally, as theorists, allow our observational friends to go and verify our predictions. And we did that, and wouldn't you know it, they came back saying that it was not true in this case. The universe was accelerating. And there were two groups of supernova observers that measured this. One of them was called the High Redshift Supernova Team. The subtitle was Measuring the Deceleration of the Universe. So they removed that subtitle from the papers that they started writing once they found the universe is accelerating. The good news is that type 1a supernovae, which result from white dwarf stars onto which you dribble a bunch of matter until they blow up, are standardizable candles. The Chandrasekhar limit, which tells you when a white dwarf will collapse and become a supernova, is basically the same everywhere in the universe at every time. So all these explosions are basically the same brightness. They're not exactly the same brightness, but there turns out to be a one-parameter family of possibilities. And if you measure the shape of the curve of brightness versus time, you can correct for the fact that the intrinsic brightnesses are a little bit different and figure out how bright the supernova really was. And if you know how bright it really was, and you know how bright it appears, you know how far away it was. So here, in inextricably confusing astronomers' units, is size of the universe versus distance to supernova for data that was collected in 2003. And what you see on the top here is a curve that would explain the data if the universe were accelerating. Here at the bottom is a curve for a universe that is decelerating. And believe it or not, this curve fits much, much better. So the prediction that the universe is full of nothing but matter and radiation is not true. There's something that makes the universe accelerate. Provisionally, we call that stuff dark energy. And it is not true that we know nothing about dark energy. There are properties that dark energy has to have for it to fit the data. So it must be smoothly distributed through space. This is a photograph I took in my laboratory of dark energy. You take a little cube of space. You remove from it everything. You remove all the particles, all the matter and radiation, all of the dark matter that you can, so it's empty. And you say, how much energy is there in that empty cubic centimeter of space? And in general relativity, there's no reason why the answer should be zero. There's a constant of nature, which is the amount of energy per cubic centimeter of empty space, called the vacuum energy. And that's the simplest possibility for what the dark energy is. If we've measured this, the answer is 10 to the minus 8 ergs per cubic centimeter. That's how much energy empty space itself has. So we don't know that the vacuum energy is the dark energy. It's just the simplest possibility. What we know is it's smoothly distributed through space because we didn't detect more dark energy in a cluster of galaxies than outside. It's something that exists both inside and outside bound systems. It varies slowly, if at all, with time because that's what makes the universe accelerate. If you go back to the Friedman equation and try to get A dot to increase, what you need is a contribution to rho that doesn't go down as the universe expands. And then if energy is conserved in general relativity, a slowly varying source has a negative pressure. P is of order minus rho, where this is the pressure and that's the energy density. So this is a crazy idea, of course. This is something that you don't want to believe is true. You want to believe the observers made a mistake. That would make you happier as a theorist. So you let them check. You let other observers go and ask, you know, how much stuff is there in the universe? And basically, they do the gravitational lensing experiment again, except they use the entire universe rather than a cluster of galaxies. They take a picture of the cosmic microwave background, the leftover relic radiation from the Big Bang, This was a snapshot of the universe 380,000 years after the Big Bang, and these little ripples are the differences in temperature from place to place due to differences in density. Now, we know that these ripples have a characteristic size, because this snapshot is when the universe is about 380,000 years after the Big Bang. The characteristic physical size of these ripples is about 380,000 light years across. If you then know the geometry of space through which the photons traveled to get from there to here, you could predict the angular scale that you should see them. The answer is that to fit the data here, the universe has to be spatially flat. It has to have a geometry where kappa equals zero in the language we introduced before, neither positively curved nor negatively curved. However, the amount of matter in the universe, both dark matter plus ordinary matter, is only 30% of what you need to make the universe spatially flat. So 70% of the universe is something else that is not matter, it is not radiation, we call it dark energy. The dark energy that makes the universe spatially flat is the same as the dark energy that makes the universe accelerate in this way of telling the story. So another way to put it all together is to invent a density parameter, omega, which is just telling you the energy density in different forms, but normalized in such a way so that when omega equals 1, the universe is spatially flat. And then you divide it up into omega matter and omega dark energy. By measuring dynamical features of matter, you find that omega matter is about 0.3. That's clusters here. By measuring the supernovae, you find that omega dark energy needs to be a positive number. That's the blue contours here. By measuring the microwave background, you find that omega matter plus omega lambda needs to be approximately 1. That's the green CMB curves here. And they overlap at a point where omega matter is about 0.3, omega dark energy is about 0.7. The crucial thing to take away from this plot is that you can disbelieve any one of these kinds of experiments, and the constraints don't change in any important way. So you don't have to believe the supernovae at all. You can believe they were all just made up. Someone was fabricating all that data. You still need to believe that the universe is accelerating and dominated by dark energy. So it is really no longer worth your effort to come up with reasons why the supernova people might have made some terrible mistake. Your effort should be expended in trying to understand this pie chart. This pie chart says that 5% of this stuff is ordinary matter, 25% dark energy, 70%, 25% dark matter, 70% dark energy. Well, there are issues with this universe. If I had assigned designing a universe to any of you as a homework assignment, you could have done better than this universe. This is a C-minus kind of universe that we live in right now. Until we rewrite the paper and do a better job explaining why it's this way rather than some other way. So that is the project we're embarked on right now. Here are three possibilities that we're playing around with. So, if you have not heard a talk like this before, you think that the vacuum energy or the cosmological constant is some esoteric, weird thing. Part of the purpose of my talk will be to renormalize your expectations by talking about dynamical dark energy and modified gravity so that by the end you go, oh yes, the vacuum energy. That's just the simplest thing in the world. I'm going to believe that because these other things are crazy. So I will talk in turn about the possibilities of why we might have vacuum energy in empty space, how dark energy could be dynamical, maybe even detectable, or whether or not Einstein could be wrong, after all, and gravity doesn't work that way on large scales. So you probably have heard the story of the vacuum energy, or what Einstein called the cosmological constant, the amount of energy density that should be in every little point of empty space. The real problem with the vacuum energy is not that the idea of vacuum energy is in any way difficult to fit into physics. It's in fact the opposite. That once you open the door to the possibility of vacuum energy, you can calculate how much there should be. And even if you don't know where to start, you know that there's a contribution from your classical starting point given to you by quantum mechanics. In quantum mechanics, empty space is not a boring place. It is hopping and alive with activity. There are particles popping in and out of existence all the time. This is just because of the uncertainty principle. The same principle that tells you that you cannot pin down a simple harmonic oscillator to zero kinetic energy and zero potential energy tells you that you cannot pin down quantum fields to have no particles in them. Even in the lowest energy state of a quantum field, there are still fluctuations where, let's say, electron-positron pairs pop in and out of the vacuum. We know that these virtual particles are there. Again, it is not worth your effort to explain why these virtual particles are not there, their effects have been detected. The effects of these virtual particles give rise to the Lamb shift in atomic physics, not to mention all sorts of precision tests of particle physics and QED tell us that these really are there, and that, for example, these E plus E minus pairs couple to photons. However, one of the nice things about gravity is that everything couples to gravity, so if these virtual fluctuations are there and couple to photons, they should be there and coupling to gravitons, and you can estimate how big the effect should be. These virtual fluctuations coupling to gravitons are what give rise to the quantum mechanical contributions to the vacuum energy. How big is that contribution? Well, you add up all the fluctuations and you get infinity. That does not bother you because you are a highly trained quantum field theorist. You've been there before with infinity and you know what to do. You're going to regularize your theory and maybe someday renormalize it. Right now, what you will say is just that the reason you got infinity is because you included contributions from frequencies of the virtual particles that were higher than the Planck energy. Maybe that's not okay because the Planck scale is where quantum gravity should become important. We don't know what happens there. Perhaps we should not include those modes higher than the Planck scale. That's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. And then, if you cut off those modes, what you find is the vacuum energy should be one Planck energy per Planck volume, which is 10 to the 120 times bigger than the vacuum energy you have observed, which even by cosmology standards is a big disagreement between theory and observation. You cannot blame the observers for this one. This is the theorist's fault. They need to deal with that. How could they possibly deal with it? I have no idea how to possibly deal with it, but I will show you how desperate the situation is by giving you the best theory on the market. If you're a particle physicist, or you're friends with particle physicists, or you pretend to be friends with particle physicists, they carry around these books called the Particle Data Book that are filled with all the numbers they have measured, all the cross-sections and masses of lifetime of the particles. The gravitational physicist data book is much smaller than that. Until recently, only had one number in it, which is Newton's constant. We have now doubled the size of the gravitational physics data book. There's another number in there, the cosmological constant or the vacuum energy. If we put these two numbers on equal footing by changing to natural units where h bar equals c equals 1, in electron volts, you have the Planck energy associated with Newton's constant, 10 to the 27 electron volts. The vacuum scale associated with lambda is 10 to the minus 3 eV. Or if you switch to TeV per trillion electron volts, the Planck scale is 10 to the plus 15, and the vacuum scale is 10 to the minus 15. And then you notice that the geometric mean of 10 to the plus 15 and 10 to the minus 15 is 1, and 1 TeV is suspiciously the scale at which particle physics happens. It should be the scale at which supersymmetry is broken, if you believe in low-energy supersymmetry breaking. It is within order of magnitude of the electroweak symmetry breaking scale. So you say to yourself, maybe there is a theory that says that particle physics should have an energy scale, which is the geometric mean of the Planck scale and the vacuum scale. All I need to do is invent that theory, and I've solved the problem. That's the best we can do right now. That is the state of the art in understanding the vacuum energy. The best theories we have actually predict that these two scales should be the same, not 15 orders of magnitude different. So if you could solve this problem, if you could invent a theory that said that the vacuum energy scale should be equal to the particle physics scale times the particle physics scale divided by the Planck scale, you're done. Let me know if you do that, and we'll write a paper together. The desperate situation that this has put us in has led people to ask the following question. What if there are other parts of our universe which we don't observe where things are different? So we observe a finite amount of universe. The universe is about 14 billion years old. Light travels at 1 light year per year. So we can't see beyond 14 billion light years away. The part that we can see of the universe looks pretty smooth and uniform everywhere, but it's perfectly allowed to imagine that very, very far away, past what we can see, conditions are very, very different. So informally, we can say, what if there are many, many disconnected universes? They don't really have to be disconnected. They can be connected, but they're so far away that we can't observe them. By different universes, we mean that they are places that have different conditions in them. So the constants of nature might be different in different pieces of this large ensemble of universes, including the vacuum energy. So the vacuum energy could be the Planck scale in some places, it could be minus the Planck scale in other places, and at other places it's some numbers in between. If that is true, then within this ensemble there is a huge selection effect, because intelligent life can only arise in those places where the cosmological constant is not very large. If the vacuum energy were plus the Planck scale, the acceleration of the universe would be so big you could not make a proton, much less an atom or a cosmologist. If the vacuum energy were large and negative, the universe would re-collapse in a Planck time, and again, you don't have time to do anything interesting. So it's just like saying in the solar system, why is it that life arose on the surface of the Earth rather than the surface of the Sun, which is much bigger, or the vacuum in between, which is much, much bigger? Why is that? Is that a big puzzle? This is not a big puzzle, because the surface of the Earth is much more hospitable to intelligent life than the surface of the Sun. So if there really are different parts of the universe where conditions are very, very different, it is not a surprise that we are sitting here in one of those parts where the conditions allow us to exist. The question is, can you have these hypotheses come true? And people are now saying that maybe you can. So string theorists, bless their hearts, used to try very hard to explain why the cosmological constant were zero. Now, for the first time in the history of string theory, it is being driven by a desire to explain the data. And the data tell us that there's a tiny non-zero vacuum energy. So they've realized that, in fact, they are not going to find one unique solution to the low-energy string theory four-dimensional vacuum state. If you can find one that has a small non-zero vacuum energy, then it appears that you can find another 10 to the 500 that also has some amount of vacuum energy. And the reason why is just because string theory really wants to live in 10 or 11 space-time dimensions, and we live in 4. So you have to compactify 6 or 7 spatial dimensions, and you ask yourself, how many different ways are there to compactify these extra dimensions? And you get numbers like 10 to the 500. That's because in some compact manifold, you have different topologies for the manifold, you have different fluxes treading different parts of the manifold, and you have different membranes wrapping around different cycles in the manifold. You can put these together in all sorts of different ways. So what happens in such a situation is that the vacuum energy that we observe in our low-energy four-dimensional world comes from a set of contributions from the topology, from the geometry, from the fluxes, and from the brains, each of which are of order the Planck scale, but they cancel in different ways because some of them are positive and some of them are negative. So there's 10 to the 500 different possibilities. Some of them are going to be big and positive. Some of them are going to be big and negative. And one of them will be small enough to explain our world. The question is, will these different possibilities be realized in this large ensemble? And there, inflation comes to the rescue. If you believe in inflation, you can take a tiny little part of the universe, some patch in some state, and expand it from subatomic scales to the size of our universe today. So the macroscopic picture of the very ultra-large-scale structure of space-time might look something like this, where each of these different colors represents a different low-energy state for the universe. And we live, you know, here, in that little green spot. But in all these other spots, you have different compactifications with very, very different laws of nature. So it is correct to say that it may be true that we live in an ensemble of different possibilities, and the reason we observe the vacuum energy to be small is because we need to observe the vacuum energy to be small to live there. On the other hand, there's a problem in actually calculating anything. So sometimes people are more ambitious and they say, let's take this landscape of different possibilities and use it to calculate the expectation value of some particle physics parameter. And here's the problem with doing that. What you want to do is to calculate the number of observers who are measuring a certain property. So you would sum over all the different possible vacuum states, asking whether or not that vacuum state has that property, and this is what string theorists right now are trying very hard to do. However, you would then multiply by the volume of space that is actually realized in that vacuum, and presumably cosmology determines this, and no one knows what the answer is. According to inflation, this factor could be between zero and infinity for different vacuum states. There's another thing that you then calculate, which is the density of observers in that vacuum, and that's just hopeless, as far as I know. I have no idea of how to calculate that. So what people are so far trying to do is to estimate this number by calculating this number and setting these two unknown numbers between 0 and infinity to be a constant. It is like saying x equals a times b, a equals 3, what is x? And we don't know how to do that yet, so What I'm trying to say is I'm trying to be neither religiously pro-anthropic principle or anti-it. It may be true that the value that we observe for the vacuum energy is the result of environmental selection in some wide landscape of possibilities, but it is not true that we are currently at the state of the art where we can explain any conscious nature using that mechanism. So that's something to keep in the back of our minds, but meanwhile, we're going to try to sort of push forward. Don't complain, it's not that bad. We're going to push forward with other possibilities because some of them have closer ties to experiments. So here's another possibility. Maybe there secretly is some law of nature we haven't yet discovered that sets the vacuum energy equal to zero, the thing that we were looking for 10 years ago. But then you ask, why is the universe accelerating? And the answer is because some dynamical component of the universe, which is not quite constant but nearly constant, is playing the role of the dark energy. This is not hard to arrange. All you have to do is get a scalar field with a potential. And all cosmologists, when they enter graduate school, are handed a scalar field, and they're told, you know, solve for this scalar field to explain everything in the universe. So it used to be that they solved it for inflation. Now they're using it for dark energy. So if you have a scalar field with a potential, its energy density in a homogeneous universe comes from kinetic energy, 1/2 phi dot squared, and potential energy. So if the slope of this potential is sufficiently shallow, the field will not have rolled down to the bottom already. It will take literally billions of years to roll down to the bottom. And then the potential energy is dominating over the kinetic energy, and you have a nearly constant energy density. That's what you need to explain the vacuum energy. So this idea is quintessence could be the dark energy of the universe, slowly varying as a function of time. The good news is that it's an observationally interesting possibility. By doing high-precision cosmology, we can, in principle, tell the difference between a truly constant vacuum energy and a slowly varying dynamical quintessence field. The bad news is that the amount of fine-tuning you need to do to make this work has only gone up from what you needed to do in the pure cosmological constant idea. Not only do you have to have the amount of vacuum energy or the amount of potential energy to be small, like you did before, but now you have to fine-tune the slope of this potential. So to quantify that, you can calculate what the mass of the scalar field needs to be, and it's less than 10 to the minus 33 electron volts. So scalar fields, you might know in particle physics, don't want to be light. They want to be heavy. There's a major problem in particle physics called the hierarchy problem, which is basically why is the Higgs mass 10 to the 11 electron volts, which is so small compared to the Planck scale. So 10 to the plus 11 electron volts is small and a big problem. 10 to the minus 33 electron volts is a very, very, very small number and a very, very correspondingly big problem. Why would you have such a light scalar field? Nevertheless, you plunge forward and say, it's a testable idea, so no matter how silly it is, we will test it. And what cosmologists generally do is to actually invent a parameter W called the equation of state parameter, which is really just a secret code for how fast the energy density in this dark energy is changing as the universe expands. If P is the pressure of the dark energy and rho is the energy density, W is P divided by rho, and rho scales as A to the minus 3 times 1 plus W. So for example, in the limit where your matter, where you're slowly moving particles with no pressure at all, then W equals 0, rho goes as A to the minus 3, which is correct. If your vacuum energy, W equals minus 1, because then rho goes as A to the minus 0, which is a constant, which is right. So you can ask, imagining that the universe is spatially flat, that kappa equals 0, replace the two-dimensional parameter space of omega matter and omega lambda by omega matter and W, and then what are the limits on W? So the supernovae give you a banana like this. The microwave background gives you a squash like this. And you can combine the clusters of galaxies with the microwave background to get this blob that is homing in on, guess what, minus 1 for W, which is the vacuum energy, and about 0.25 or 0.3 for omega matter. However, this is not actually the most recent data because the data they keep collecting more data, which is kind of annoying for those of us who want to give talks. But there's still room to play here. If you look at these data at the 2 sigma level, you could fit in anything for W between minus 0.4 and minus 1.5, which is a large range of possibilities. So one of the major programs for observational cosmology is to narrow this range down. Meanwhile, we theorists are asking, what would we learn by measuring different values of W? For example, what if we measured that W was less than minus 1? If you look at this plot, if you look at this formula, when W is minus 1, rho is a constant. When W is minus 0.9, rho is slowly diminishing. But when W is minus 1.1, rho is slowly going up. So not only is the energy of the universe going up, but the energy density, the energy per cubic centimeter is going up if W is less than minus 1. And that seems scary to us. We think that that's bad, that the energy density should be going up. So we try to say, is it actually bad, or is it just scary and we should learn to live with it? Well, Robert Caldwell said, I don't care if you think it's bad. I can write down a field theory in which it happens. It's not even that difficult. All I do is take your field theory with a scalar field and put a minus sign in front of the kinetic energy. So how hard was that? And this is called a ghost or phantom field. So now the phantom field has an energy density which is minus phi dot squared plus the potential. And the equations of motion for a phantom field have the property that fields roll up to the top of their potentials rather than rolling down to the bottom. So the phantom field starts here, and as the universe expands, it rolls up here, oscillates around the maximum, and comes to rest right there. That's all that happens. And so Caldwell says, look, W is certainly less than minus 1 because you went from a small amount of energy density to a large amount of energy density. So what's wrong with that? Well, it is scary to have W less than minus 1 because it violates the dominant energy condition, which means that the vacuum is unstable to decay. If you took this phantom field and quantized it to make particles, the individual particles would have a negative mass. Not a negative mass squared like a tachyon, but the actual particle would have a negative mass. So empty space in this theory could decay into a set of positive energy particles like gravitons plus a set of negative energy particles of these phantom particles. So what you would want to ask is this ruled out? What is the decay rate in this theory to go from the vacuum to a bunch of positive energy particles and a bunch of negative energy particles? The answer is the decay rate is infinity. And you go, well, that doesn't bother me. Because the reason why it was infinity is because the phase space for these decays was infinitely big because I could have an arbitrarily large positive momentum for these particles and cancel it with an arbitrarily large negative momentum for these. So if you cut on the theory to make the momentum transfer some constant number or less, then you can in fact get a finite number. And if the constant that you the cutoff you put on it is 10 to the minus 3 electron volts, this happens less than once per history of the universe, and you are safe. So does that mean that it works or not? I'm not going to tell you the answer to that. What I'm going to tell you is the moral of the story that you should take away, which is that as an experimentalist, you should not believe the theorists when they tell you something can't happen. Because when theorists say that something can't happen, they're making some assumptions, and those assumptions might not be right in the real world. But as a theorist, when you try to write down a model, you better check that it's not instantly ruled out without doing any experiments at all. You need to think about this not just as playing with cosmology and the expansion of the universe, but this is physics. You know, if you write down a field theory, there are particles there, and you need to figure out what they can do. It has actually been done by Cunningham et al. Have figured out ways to put cutoffs on theories like this and make perfectly sensible models of dark energy where W can temporarily be less than minus 1. They're not elegant or what you'd expect, but they're there, so experimentally we should certainly go look for them. So the other thing I want to point out about dynamical dark energy is once you go from a constant number to a field, that field is again a player in the game of particle physics. It can interact with other things. The simplest possible model we have of the dark sector is something like this. We have ordinary matter, 5%. We know that the ordinary matter of which we are made interacts with itself through the standard model. And then 95% of the stuff in the universe is dark matter and dark energy, a whole dark sector that we don't know that much about. In the simplest model, the only interactions between dark energy, dark matter, and ordinary matter are through gravity. But we're just beginning to explore this stuff. We can certainly imagine the possibility of a set of interactions between everything. Dark energy can interact with itself through evolution and perturbations. Dark matter can interact with itself through scattering or annihilation of dark matter particles. We hope that the dark matter can interact with ordinary matter because we're trying to detect it and produce it in particle accelerators. It's also possible that the dark matter interacts in some interesting way with the dark energy, or even if we're really lucky, that the dark energy interacts in some interesting way with the ordinary matter. In other words, just as we can imagine experiments to directly detect dark matter, we could imagine experiments to directly detect the dark energy. Ordinarily, since we haven't detected it already, dark energy theorists set all the interactions between dark energy and ordinary matter to zero. Otherwise, you might have detected it already. But it's cheating to set the interactions of dark energy and ordinary matter to zero, because we know that dark energy interacts with gravity, and gravity interacts with ordinary matter. And the miracle of quantum field theory is that if A interacts with B and B interacts with C, then through loop diagrams, A will interact with C. So you could imagine a dark energy particle, a quintessence particle, interacting with quantum gravity, by which we mean with virtual black holes or massive superstring states or something like that, and those guys interacting with photons. So if you ever want to know what quantum gravity looks like, it is a shiny gray ellipsoid. It looks just like that. And you can even estimate the size of this interaction. It's just basically given by a dimensionful coupling constant. It looks like 1 over the Planck scale. That's basically as small as it could be. You can make it bigger than that, but that's as small as it could sensibly be in the absence of some symmetry. Then you ask, what is the experimental limit? The experimental limit is 10 to the minus 5 over the Planck scale. In other words, you should already have directly detected the dark energy, you didn't. So you need to think harder about why, if there is dynamical dark energy, has not yet been showing up in our lab. So here's what I mean when I say we should already have detected it. You have a field, phi, which has a mass of 10 to the minus 33 electron volts. That's like having a Compton wavelength of 10 billion light years. So phi gives rise to a long-range force. We know of two long-range forces, gravity and electromagnetism. We have not ever detected a phi force. We've looked for it. It would show up in Etbosch experiments, torsion ballast experiments, like done at the University of Washington. We haven't seen it yet. That's where this number, 10 to the minus 5, comes from. This is a force that should be comparable in strength to gravity, but composition dependent. Different objects made of different things should be falling at different rates. We don't see that. Another effect that should happen is if the scalar field, which is quintessence, is evolving as the universe expands, its expectation value should be pushing around other observed so-called constants of nature, such as defined structure constant alpha. The reason why this is interesting is, of course, because people have claimed that alpha, the defined structure constant, is changing as a function of time. Here is a plot of some binned data from Webb et al., where you go from redshifts of 1 to 3, you plot alpha, delta alpha over alpha, and they claim that it has changed by a factor of 10 to the minus 5 in between high redshift and today. Now, more recently, other data have come along that fit right on this straight line, and they do not see any change in the variation of alpha. But I am not going to take any position on whose data is correct, except to say that things like this, experiments like this, are crucially important to do and to get right. Because if you actually establish that there is a change of the fine structure constant through time, that would be strong evidence that you have found quintessence directly, and would be a clue into what the dark energy is. Even if you don't, there are more elaborate games you can play. It turns out that you can couple the dark energy to neutrinos in a different way than you couple it to other particles like photons or quarks. There is a theory called Mavans for mass-varying neutrinos, where the mass of neutrinos depends on the value of the dark energy field. And it turns out that you can actually make all sorts of neutrino experiments consistent with this, and it will be tested at new experiments like Miniboom that have not yet come online. Finally, if you do put a symmetry in your theory that suppresses these couplings, that explains why they are so small, it turns out that there is one coupling that escapes, that is not suppressed by these symmetries, and that is a pseudo-scalar coupling of phi to E dot B, the electric field times the magnetic field for photons. And that also has a signature. The signature here is that if you emit a photon, its polarization will rotate. Its linear polarization state will slowly rotate as phi changes. So if you look at the microwave background or distant galaxies, all of their polarizations will be shifted by some amount depending on their redshift. People have looked for this effect and not found it yet, but unlike these effects, the precision of these data are not yet good enough to say that we should have found it. In other words, there is still room out there for someone to improve this experiment and directly detect the dark energy, even if there exists a symmetry that is suppressing its couplings. And if you did that, you would win the Nobel Prize. So I'm encouraging you to do that. No one ever listens to me when I say that you should go do this. Okay, but we haven't detected it yet. We're doing better. We're building new experiments to measure W, and we're thinking as hard as we can about more direct detection. Meanwhile, we have to answer the question that is asked to us at coffee breaks by our fellow physicists, and we've never answered it before, which is, are you really absolutely sure that this dark energy stuff exists? We are sure that something is happening. We're sure the universe is accelerating. I'm sure of that. I'm not willing to spend any thought processes worrying that the universe is not actually accelerating. But I don't know why. What I do is I infer the existence of dark energy by taking general relativity, plugging it into the Friedman equation, like I showed you, and showing that the Friedman equation only leads to an accelerating universe if there is dark energy. The other logical possibility is that the Friedman equation is not right. The Friedman equation is the prediction of general relativity, but the expansion of the universe right now is in a regime very far outside any direct test that we have of general relativity. So you might ask, maybe Einstein's equation doesn't work for cosmology. But that would not be exactly right. Here is a plot of the scale factor versus the Hubble constant, and this red line is the prediction of the standard model of cosmology. The slope of this red line is basically telling you what is the energy density of the stuff that makes up the universe. So there's one slope during the radiation-dominated era, there's another slope during the matter-dominated era, and another slope during the dark energy-dominated era. The fact that we live right there at the bump is, of course, a coincidence. The fact that today is the era when the dark energy and the matter in the universe are comparable to each other, we'd like to know the answer to that. However, we have data about what was going on up here from Big Bang nucleosynthesis. When the universe was 1 minute old, it was a nuclear reactor. It was turning free protons and neutrons into helium, lithium, and deuterium. And the rate at which it was turning them, doing those reactions, depends on the expansion rate of the universe. And we can see those light element abundances today and compare to what they should have been from back then. These little line segments are what the universe could have been doing when it was 1 minute old to produce the right light element abundances. So you can see that compared to the standard picture, it is true that you could start nucleosynthesis with a lower expansion rate than usual, but only if you ended with a higher expansion rate than usual, or vice versa. The average of these lines is exactly the standard picture. So in particular, the universe was not somewhere down here during Big Bang nucleosynthesis. It was not a nearly straight line throughout the whole history of the universe. Basically, from today to nucleosynthesis, the gross features of this curve were what Einstein's equation predicts it should be. So if you are going to modify gravity to explain the acceleration of the universe, you don't modify the Friedman equation once and for all. You say that its behavior has changed recently. You have to put a scale into the problem and say that when the universe reached a certain size or reached a certain expansion rate, things changed. Something happened. So you have to modify gravity so that it gets modified now. That's not to say you can't do it. You can try to do it. Here's one attempt to do it. This is called DGP gravity, after Diwali, Gavadadze, and Porati. And they have a brain world. So they say that our three-dimensional world that we see is a three-brain embedded in a four-spatial-dimensional universe, so a four-plus-one-dimensional universe overall. This is a game that has become very popular to be played, again, since 1998, when people realized that extra dimensions could be big if there's a brain on which all the particles of the standard model are stuck. So the reason we don't directly see the extra dimension is because photons and electrons and quarks are all stuck on this brain. The only thing that can leak out is gravity. Now, ordinarily, if you're in a situation like that, the extra dimension can't be very big because gravity has a 1 over r squared force law. And if you have three dimensions of space, that's what you expect. But if you have four dimensions of space, you expect 1 over r cubed. So ordinarily, you say even if there is a slightly big extra dimension, it still can't be that big. It has to be about a tenth of a millimeter or smaller. What DG and P figured out is that this extra dimension could be infinitely big by making gravity much, much stronger in the bulk. If gravity is weak on the brain, then the gravitational field of the sun or the earth wants to stay on the brain. And what you get is, for something with a Schwarzschild radius of 2gm, you have some gravitating body, there's a region around there where things look like ordinary four-dimensional general relativity. Gravity does not escape off of the brain because it takes energy to do that. If you go far enough away, past this distance RC, gravity becomes five-dimensional again. And RC is basically the dimensional quantity that comes in to the action for this theory. This is just the action for good old four-dimensional gravity. You've added a five-dimensional piece to it, but you've suppressed it by 1 over some huge number. So RC is a huge number of order the Hubble length today, 10 billion light years. So this is actually telling you the gravity is stronger. The effective Planck scale in there is actually much lower than it is in our four-dimensional world. In between this region where gravity is four-dimensional and five-dimensional, it looks like a scalar tensor theory of gravity. The effective value of Newton's constant is growing at some rate. So this is a theory which remarkably is consistent with observations as far as anyone knows. People have been writing papers saying that it's inconsistent with theory, that you actually can't make this theory work, and that's an interesting question that I'm not going to address today. What I'm going to talk about is the fact that this theory makes the universe accelerate. So in DGP gravity, you can write down what is the Friedmann equation. What is the equation relating the expansion rate of the universe to the energy density? And just setting kappa equal to 0 for convenience, here is the Friedmann equation that ordinarily would just have h squared is 8 pi g over 3 rho. So the extra feature of DGP gravity is there is a minus h over rc in here. And what that means is that even when rho equals 0, there's a solution to this equation where h is not 0. You can solve this equation where h equals 1 over rc even when there's no matter in the universe. So h equals constant is a universe that is accelerating. If you have a Hubble constant, the Hubble constant being constant tells you that there's a fixed amount of time for the universe to double in size. So a universe that doubles in size every 10 billion light years is one in which you see individual galaxies accelerate away from you. So that actually almost sort of fits the data. This is not the same as a cosmological constant. This is not W equals minus 1. If you calculated the effective value of W in this theory, it would be something like minus 0.6 or minus 0.7, which you might remember is sort of marginally consistent with the data as we know them not right now. It's not nearly as good a fit as W equals minus 1, but it's not completely ruled out either, so it's still worth thinking about. What we would like to do is to say, well, this is not just a theory of the expansion. This is a whole new theory of gravity. So we can ask what other tests we have of gravity in the very weak field regime that might reveal whether or not this theory is right, in particular, looking at evolution of perturbations in the universe. So this is an expanding universe with some mode of perturbation, some wavelength of perturbation on very large scales. And I told you that when things are close to a gravitating source, gravity looks four-dimensional. As they grow farther away, things become scalar tensor and then five-dimensional. So as the universe expands, a mode that expands along with the universe goes from being four-dimensional general relativity to being described by the DGP theory where there's scalar tensor or five-dimensional behavior. So what that means is that long wavelength modes late in the universe's history will evolve differently in this theory than they do in general relativity. In particular, this is what happens. Here is the Newtonian gravitational potential for some perturbation of the universe. And these are perturbations on different scales, from small scales to large scales. What happens is small scales come inside the Hubble radius at earlier times. If they come in early enough, the universe is radiation dominated and the Newtonian gravitational potential plummets and they just sort of wiggle around at a number close to zero. If you come in at intermediate times, you plummet while the universe is radiation dominated. Then when the universe is matter dominated, the Newtonian gravitational potential for a perturbation remains approximately constant. That's just the fact of the equation, so there's a balance between the gravitational pull of the matter and the expansion of the universe. Now in ordinary cosmology, where ordinary means there's a cosmological constant, when the cosmological constant kicks in, the expansion wins out over the gravitational pull of the matter, and the potential begins to fall again. But, as it turns out, in the DGP model, that's when gravity becomes strong. At late times in weak gravitational fields, gravity becomes stronger than you think, and the evolution of the modes to increase in size rather than decrease in size. And this actually shows up in the microwave background. So here is, sadly, not an updated plot. As you know, the WMAP satellite last week came out with new data. I don't have that here, but it's the same basic picture. This is the anisotropy in the microwave background, a plot you may be familiar with that looks like this. So this is the anisotropy of the microwave background on very, very large scales. This is the quadrupole, the largest scale you can observe, the octopole, etc. The blue curve is the prediction of lambda CDM, so that's vacuum energy and cold dark matter. The red curve is our theory of what the prediction is for DGP gravity, for this modified gravity model where you have a brain and no explicit vacuum energy. What you see is that the actual amount of perturbations on the largest possible scales are lower in DGP gravity than in ordinary lambda CDM. The reason why that's interesting is because the data are also lower than the predictions of lambda CDM. So, in fact, it is important that I get the new data up here on the plot because they're less low now than they were 2 weeks ago. But 2 weeks ago, I could have told you that this point right here is noticeably lower than the prediction from lambda CDM. This is a point right there, and it is very much lower than the prediction, and that is still true. So since DGP has less anisotropy on large scales, and since the universe has less anisotropy on large scales than lambda CDM does, if all you're trying to do is fit the microwave background, DGP gravity is a better fit than the lambda CDM model. However, remember, it was not as good a fit to the supernova data. And it turns out that if you plug both in at once, try to fit both the supernovae and the microwave background, lambda CDM is still fitting better. So this is not definitive. We don't know the answer yet. But what I wanted to suggest to you is that modified gravity could be doing something in some form, even if it's not the form of DGP gravity. So I'm running out of time, so let me zip through the last theory I had to show you, which is really, I like to call it the dumbest thing you could possibly do to try to modify Einstein's equations. So rather than starting from some complicated brain world model, what we did is to say, what if you just wanted to modify gravity? What if you didn't know why, you didn't care where it came from, you just want to ask yourselves, in what way could gravity be modified? So you might start with the action for gravity. R is the curvature scalar at every point in space. The action for a field theory is the integral of some scalar over space-time. So it's no surprise that general relativity is the integral of this very, very simple scalar quantity. If you want to modify gravity at late times, one strategy might be change this function to something that becomes different when the curvature becomes small. So we said, what if you take R and subtract 1 over R, so that when R becomes small, this effect kicks in? Well, indeed, you can solve this equation. You can get equations of motion from this action, you can solve them, and you can show that an accelerating universe is a solution to this equation, whereas flat space-time is not. You can make the universe accelerate, you can fit the supernova data very, very well. The problem is that every theory of this form, every theory where you go from R to some function of R, turns on a new scalar field. It turns out that in the geometry of space, there is a spin 2 particle called the graviton, but there is also a scalar particle. Usually, in general relativity, the scalar particle is non-dynamical. It doesn't do anything, but by changing the theory, you've brought it to life. And then by testing gravity in the solar system, for example, the Cassini mission, which you think was launched to take pretty pictures of Saturn, but in fact was launched to test general relativity to exquisite precision. The Cassini mission bounced signals off of the Earth next to the gravitational field of the Sun, and we measured the time delay from those signals. And we found that there is the Brown-Sicky parameter, which in this theory is zero, and this experiment constrains to be greater than 40,000. So this theory is ruled out. You tried to make the smallest possible change in general relativity, but you find that general relativity is actually quite a special theory. You can't change it very much without running into experimental consequences. And this is more or less a generic problem. Anytime you try to change gravity at long distances in the infrared, you bring new degrees of freedom to life. That's just because the dynamics of spin 2 gravitons is essentially unique. The loophole to this is that we don't want to add new degrees of freedom. We don't want to change the behavior of gravity in the weak field regime except for this Friedman equation right here. The Friedman equation relates the expansion rate to the energy density. This is not an equation that has anything to do with gravitons or the propagation of the gravitational field in empty space. This is a constraint equation that relates the expansion rate instantaneously to the energy density. So you can ask, could we change the constraint structure of general relativity in a way to make the universe accelerate at late times without running into new degrees of freedom? The answer is yes. I am running out of time, so I can't tell you how to do it. You could ask me how I did it, but there's an equation, so it must be science. And this, at the end of the day, is what you get for a new Friedman equation. Again, it's not what you would guess. Remember, we used to have h squared is 8 pi g over 3 rho. Now we have all these things that look like a density-dependent Newton's constant and a potential energy. The point is, you can get an effective thing that you think is a dark energy, an effective thing you think is W. It can be greater than or less than minus 1, no new degrees of freedom, no ghosts, no instability of the vacuum. We're working right now on doing the same thing we did with DGP gravity, getting the evolution of perturbations, and what we see is a similar effect. Namely that in this new theory, modified source gravity, gravity becomes strong at low densities, at low curvatures, and therefore the perturbations are not suppressed when the universe begins to expand, accelerate. They are actually growing. So this leads to advice for our observer friends. There are different ways that people are now trying to experimentally test the evolution of the dark energy. Some of them are purely kinematic. They're only sensitive to the scale factor as a function of time. For example, the supernova observations. Also, things like baryon oscillations, which are standard rulers rather than standard candles. But there are also dynamical probes that are sensitive to both the scale factor and the growth factor for the perturbations. So not only the overall evolution of the universe, but the local behavior of the matter perturbations within it. Tests of dark energy that use both of these things include weak lensing, weak gravitational lensing to look at the overall scale of large-scale structure, and also counts of clusters, number density of clusters as a function of time. What we are saying is that if there is no dark energy, but there is instead modified gravity, if you do both these kinds of tests, you will get different answers. You will not be able to simultaneously fit both of these kinds of tests with a single value of W for the dark energy. So it's important to not just do the best thing you can do on one kind of dark energy experiment. It's important to test the dark energy using different methods and check for consistency, because what you're really doing is testing general relativity in a regime where it's never been tested before. So the conclusion is that to ask deep questions about the universe, there are two complementary approaches. These are analogous to surveillance and interrogation. There are some times when you don't have direct access to your suspect. So you can listen in on what your suspect is doing far away when they don't think that you're listening in. That's equivalent to looking with a satellite or with a telescope at the universe, which has regimes that we cannot duplicate here on Earth, regimes of high energy, large distances, long time scales. You can learn things about the universe using this sort of technique that you could never reproduce in the lab. The bad part of this technique is that, of course, usually when you listen in, the suspect is talking about the flavor of marinara sauce that they had on their pasta last night, not about their money laundering scheme. Sometimes you want to bring them in for interrogation. Sometimes you want to ask a pointed question very specifically about a particular thing that you want to know the answer to. And sometimes they will tell you. And this is analogous to doing an experiment, to colliding particles together in a certain way and watching what comes out. If you want to know how to figure out why the universe is accelerating, you don't do one of these really well. You need to do both. We're not going to figure out what the dark energy is and why the vacuum energy is just by measuring the expansion rate of the universe. We also need to know why the electric weak symmetry is broken. What is breaking supersymmetry if it exists? Are there extra dimensions of space? And we're given clues as to what to look for in these experiments by figuring out what the inventory of the universe is. The good news is that in the next 10 years, I think that there's a whole bunch of wonderful experiments designed to do both of these all at once. And I predict that actually, despite our coasting for the last 8 years, the next 10 years of cosmology are going to be giving us just as many surprises and new insights as the last 10 years were. So I think it's going to be a very exciting time. Thank you. So the question is, what kind of stuff gets redshifted along with the expansion of the universe? For example, does the wave function of a particle get expanded? Not if the particle is massive. So if you think about an electron in the orbit of a proton, right, in an atom, the thing that sets that length scale is the electromagnetic force and the mass of the electron, not the expansion rate of the universe. So a free electron moving has a momentum that is dependent on its wavelength, and the momentum will slow down. So in that sense, yes. But if the electron is bound to some proton, then its configuration is completely set by atomic physics, by nothing whatsoever to do with the universe. So that's what I meant when I said that individual systems do not expand. So your wave function or the Bohr radius or things like that do not expand along with the expansion of the universe. For gravity, it's the same story. The solar system does not expand because the universe is expanding. And I mean that not just as an approximation. Really not at all does the solar system expand because of the expansion of the universe. So to measure things like that, we really need to measure unbound systems very, very far away. Well, you can use it, but like you say, not very well. So the question is, when you're using the microwave background, at very large angular scales, there are not that many independent multipoles. So if this red line is the prediction, this pink curve is the intrinsic uncertainty in that prediction that you can never, ever, ever decrease because it's cosmic variance. It's just the fact that you only have one universe to look at. But still, you can fit this data more or less well, and then you can also try to fit other data. By looking at this alone, you will not ever tell the difference between these two curves, but you will combine this data with measurements of large-scale structure on very, very large scales, and you will try to correlate gravitational lensing with the ISW effect, and you'll do other clever cosmological things, hoping that someday you will be able to tell the difference. So I wouldn't give up hope. Yeah.
The sun is clear, but how many particles per unit cubic kilometer of space do you have to be below before the space qualifies as unbound or expanded?
Well, if you have two particles, basically the particles, let's say they're interacting gravitationally, they could be electromagnetic or whatever, but there's an effective potential that tells you what are the dynamics of these two particles with respect to each other. The point is that the expansion of the universe gives you a contribution to that effective potential, but at the end of the day, it's just the effective potential. So you include the contribution from the expansion of the universe, and once you have that contribution, if you're in a bound state in that effective potential, then you're bound. And if you're not, then you're not. So it depends on the system. There's no like cutoff, like if I have 10 particles per cubic megaparsec, I get the right answer, but it depends on the mass and the distance between the particles, but for any given system, there is a criterion.
Any more questions? If not, let's thank you again.
Thanks.